So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
Hello again, everybody. Lance Russell, Dave Brown, right along ringside. We're ready. By golly, we got a dandy of a program lined up for you today, and I think some of the matches are going to be most interesting, baby.
I think you are right.
Well, I did this because Fargo didn't have the guts to come down and do it.
This Monday night, Memphis, Daddy. When I get a hold of you, I'm going to take you and bury your head right in the mat, brother.
Well, we're going to grab him from behind over there.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. How are you doing, Wei?
Doing good, John. How are you?
We are joined by an in-studio guest this week, the one and only Dan the Mouth Lavransky, to chat about Memphis Heat. And how are you doing today, Mouth?
I'm doing good.
It's the middle of November, and it's short season for you.
John, if the temperature is above 10 degrees, I am wearing my shorts.
I left my house today wearing a winter coat. I was not aware of the temperature outside. It is 14 right now in Toronto.
If it's above 10, get the shorts out.
I can't do that. I wear long johns in this weather.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. My one buddy gives me the nickname of the Black Bear because I just seem to be so easy with the cold. I don't know what it is, but I couldn't. There's no way I could wear long underwear, not even at the coldest way.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You should tell Mouth about the Easter egg in Review and Impact from this past Friday, Wei.
You guys do Easter eggs?
Well, not purposely. last week, we were doing the show, and then you called me because we were coming to do the Stan Hansen interview.
Yes.
So I answer the phone. I'm like, oh, hey, Mouth. Yep. I talked to Stan. Are you riding your bike?
You guys were in the middle of the show when I called?
Yes, oh, and geez. I made a mental note, but unfortunately I did not make a physical note, so that phone call made its way into our podcast last week. So people got a cameo from Dan Lavransky in Review and Impact last Friday.
That's funny.
Happens quite often.
Yes. Memphis Heat is what we're discussing now. This is going to be either number one or number two when it comes to DVD of the year for 2011. And later on in the show, we're going to be joined by the executive producer, Sherman Wilmot, who's going to chat with us about the production of the documentary, a lot of the interviews he conducted, his own background. So I'm looking forward to that because, unfortunately, this is like a wrestling book that's just, it's not a very good quality book, but not out there for a lot of people to get, unlike a WWE DVD. So I'm hoping that some people can check this out and it spurs them on to go find the documentary.
Well, I think if you approach it from the fact that Memphis was the territory where all the stuff with Andy Kaufman happened and Jerry Lawler, I think that's a good jumping on point. Younger fans know about that whole situation with Andy Kaufman because of his career and the movie and all that kind of stuff. So I think if they market it somehow around that and people know about that, then they might be more interested to watch the whole thing.
Now, with you, Mouth, you kind of have the historical reference of the Memphis territory, which was, at its peak long before myself and Wei Ting were breathing. was Memphis something that you were able to follow at all? I mean, it was never up here in Canada.
Yeah, so it was pretty tough, John. You didn't get any. I mean, this part of the country was, once McMahon took over and that, it was just heavily dominated by the WWF. And before that, it was more of Mid-Atlantic was kind of the big territory around this area. So no, you couldn't see the Memphis. Honestly, my first exposure to Memphis really was the Andy Kaufman incident, and when all that started to break, then you started to see more clips. You saw a lot more clips of Memphis on the news. There was that infamous thing on Letterman when Kaufman and Lawler went on Letterman and did that whole thing. So no, it was not something that I could watch every week or anything like that. No.
When that whole Kaufman story hit, like you talk about the news, did that stuff actually air on the
Oh, Huge story.
Really? Wow.
Huge story when that broke. It started with it started gradual with the idea of Kaufman wrestling the women and stuff like that. And then after, I mean, you got to remember, he was huge at this point. Wade Taxi was a big hit, right? He was very well known as a comedian. And especially after they did the angle where Lawler gave him the pile driver and he had to wear the neck brace, that shot of him getting the pile driver was on the news all the time.
Even up in Canada. That's
yes.
So
oh, yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, no. Because wow. Andy, you got to understand, Andy Kaufman was huge. Mm. He was a big star. So that was a big deal. And the Letterman thing made a lot of waves as well because that was seen all over the country. Mm-hmm.
And watching this documentary, I mean, it was very similar to when I watched the two different DVDs on the World Class territory, and just looking at just the crowd heat at this time, when you just had such a different level of emotion when it came to these big angles. And I mean, you think of Memphis, and you think of the Lawler-Kaufman angle, the Tupelo concession brawl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's so many angles that jump out at you, and just hearing this audience here, whether it was at the Mid-South Coliseum or any of these other stops. It was just like a different level of emotion that you got from these wrestling fans at the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, because that was still in the era when the wrestling business tried its best to, you know, to keep everybody believing in it. And so it was much easier to create emotional involvement, unlike today where, you know, the WWE slaps us in the face constantly, right? Back then, I mean, it was like that even when I was really young. I remember going to see wrestling matches as a child in the 70s, and the crowds were insane. I remember I have a vivid memory of sitting beside this woman who physically started hitting me because she was so wound up with the action she was seeing in the ring. And it was just a different thing back then, you know. If they hadn't, it's that one kind of intangible thing, you know, that it's just, if they had just kept that certain level of believability there, it's so much easier to get emotionally involved. And that's what the crowds in Memphis. Plus, Memphis, you got to remember, was really crazy stuff, like the concession stand brawl and the Lawler thing. They were always doing crazy stipulation matches in Memphis and stuff like that. So I think because it was so crazy, the nature of the product being so intense, the fans were really intense too.
Well, I think two of the keys as well was just you had these very believable characters, you had very strong promos, and Jerry Jarrett even notes it in this documentary that, you know, 12,000 fans in Memphis that would attend these matches, he ventured to guess that probably 1,000 of those 12,000 fans believed that what they were seeing was real, but the rest of them, they were able to suspend their disbelief, and thus you got this context across to the audience where they reacted in such a convincing manner. Yeah. That is something I think that anyone who watches this as a reference point, it's such a different product versus today where you don't have that level of engagement.
Oh, yeah. Some of the clips in the Memphis Heat documentary are going to probably blow people's minds. Exactly. When they see just how intense these angles were and how crazy the crowd really was wrapped up in this stuff, because it's there. The Heat, the Memphis Heat is there.
They make the point at the end of the movie, though, that that the era of that type of believability would have ended anyway with the creation of cable TV, with the creation of the internet. It's just, it would have died anyway.
I think it's hard to say. Because
it is a tough one, yeah, I don't know.
I feel like that type of emotional connection now people have, I see in MMA. I see with a guy like Chael Sonnen yelling, or Josh Koscheck yelling at a Montreal crowd, you know, the Canadians suck. That's the type of emotion that I see right now.
No, you're right. That is where you get that type of emotion now. You're absolutely right. Is the MMA fans, because they feel, well, because it's real. Mm-hmm. It's real, right? So it's very easy to get emotionally engaged.
But you also get the comparison where for a number of times we've seen guys who they'll talk each other up in all of their pre-fight stuff, and literally they have said in their post-fight promo in the octagon, "We were just trying to hype up a fight. We weren't really mad at each other." Like, that has actually been said.
Yeah.
And fans still accept it. It's like, this is so this is so professional wrestling in some mm-hmm. ways, where guys fully admit we conjured up a storyline and false anger at one another to bilk you into buying this fight.
I think they still get away with it, John, because it's still a basic concept. Most of the time in pro wrestling, if we're given something that we're supposed to believe, it's pretty outrageous a lot of the time. Like, you know, cement being poured into a car or a performer falling off the roof of the building and he's okay the next day. It's a little bit more of a stretch. Whereas I think with that, even with them, the fighters admitting they're just trying to hype a fight, people still, I think underneath it, people still think, oh, yeah, I think he really, he's just saying that. I think they almost go, oh, he's just saying that. Mm-hmm. He really doesn't like him, you know?
But I think with professional wrestling, I mean, you have the obvious advantage of being able to manipulate the eventual outcome, but when you get something that feels unique and real, like the CM Punk promo, how many people after that promo were wondering, was this legitimate? What did Punk... It was believable that this guy could have grabbed the mic and said whatever he wanted, and I think that's when wrestling, when it has that just... that shred of doubt with the audience of was that real or not, that's when wrestling seems to connect. And I think that's still doable in 2011.
It is. It's just you got to find the right ways to do it. But the thing is, they might hit on it for a while, like they did with Punk, but then something seems to come along. I don't know if it's Vince getting
older. They make it what pro wrestling is today. They turn it into just another angle.
Right.
Bret and Vince was a legitimate issue, and it was something people believed in, that these two men hated each other. And 4 weeks after his return, we had cars involved, we had all this other ridiculous stuff that's part of just another wrestling angle, and people accept it as just another angle that doesn't have that connection to reality anymore.
Yeah.
It seems like they write their shows as a show, not writing reality. You know, it seems like when they get their writers involved, they start to think of it as entertainment and not... trying to mimic what reality would do better.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, since most of the writers seem to come from a Hollywood background, that seems to be, at least in the WWE, that's what Vince seems to like. You're right. You're absolutely right. I'm sure they think of it more as a TV show rather than a wrestling event or an athletic contest or a competition, you know?
It always seems to overcomplicate things, which is very different from what we were treated to in this documentary. Basic storylines back in these territory
days. And look at how, not only that, but look at, and just good, strong booking of the basic guys, because I mean, how many times did they do Bill Dundee versus Jerry Lawler? They did it 9 million times, and you know what? It worked almost every single time. Like to me, for them to be able to go back, that to me was a major revelation, because in the modern world, I mean, you got it with the territories, because two guys could have the feud in one territory and then they could move the whole thing to another territory because people didn't see what was happening. But in this day and age, you know, it's very hard to kind of do that kind of thing. And that's the one thing I thought was amazing about Memphis, is that they had this, like, almost not a huge cast of characters, but were able to keep them strong and keep the fans interested for such a long time.
And you also, to compare to today, where it seems the focus is, you know, on doing a strong television rating, being as profitable as you are with the WWE, versus here with the Memphis territory, where you had to return to all of these cities the following week, and you had to book to make sure those fans return the following week. I mean, they ran Memphis at the Mid-South Coliseum every Monday night, and they had a stretch, I think it was 11 weeks, of selling out the Mid-South Coliseum. Imagine Raw being in the same city every single Monday. It's, you couldn't even fathom that.
And that also brings up the good point, because a lot of people today like to say, well, you know, they have to rush things because there's so much TV and they got all this time to fill. And it's like, look, there you go. They were doing like 5 or 6 cities every week. Like, if that's not a lot of stuff to go, you know, it's crazy.
Or the point of saying that TNA needs to get out of the impact zone because the crowd is so stale. I feel like if you have a good product, it doesn't matter.
The crowd's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Like, in a way, like, you talk about the territory system, TNA is very much a territory that just happens to have a national broadcast platform.
Right.
In terms of the actual documentary, the presentation, the production, what were your thoughts on this from a kind of your point of view?
Well, I wasn't familiar with many of the cast of characters aside from what we got here at the Fight Network when we used to air Memphis.
Right.
So I wasn't very familiar with a lot of these people talking. So off the top, it really just kind of gets right into story after story after story. I felt it was a little bit hard to follow from my perspective, not knowing who all these people were. I think I would have liked a bit more breathing space. But then once they got into, you know, the stuff about how Lawler got into the business, about how Jimmy Hart got into the business, and then the Andy Coppin stuff, that was like when I was really hooked, because I had some frame of reference. And I thought it was a very well-done documentary. And I'm assuming for you, someone like you, Mouth, who knows all these people, like, it probably, you were probably able to connect with it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't have that issue at all, yeah. Way. No, absolutely. I know, you know, as soon as I saw Sputnik Monroe, I was more elation. It was like elation for me to go, yeah. Wow, they got Sputnik Monroe. Wow, they got Jackie Fargo. Wow, they got the Boogie Woogie Man. Like, I was sucked in right away.
I'd like to know, they have, they used pretty much as much footage of the Memphis territory as they could. Who owns that footage right now?
The Memphis tapes are this... It's really strange because it's one of the few libraries that the WWE does not own, and I don't think the ownership is... I don't think anyone has a clear idea of who owns all the Memphis footage.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, is that a lot of the Memphis stuff, because what was done, a lot of the territories, this stuff was just taped over every single week. Right?
Yeah.
Like I'm sure you noticed, Way, that most of the quality of the old clips was really poor, and actually most of those clips were from VHS, it looked to me. Yeah. They found some collectors that had some old tapes, because a lot of the original Masters of that tapes, it doesn't exist anymore.
Working here in the Fight Network, like we had to dealt with that directly, and that was the case with the Larry Madison and his St. Louis wrestling tapes as well. They were all just taped off of VHS, and like, so one of my first jobs here at the Fight Network was cutting those down. I'm like, what are these low quality tapes?
It was pretty tough,
with these commercials chopped in there. But do you know anything about that? I know there was a whole dispute between Corey Macklin
and Jerry Lawler.
Yeah,
there was because Lawler, at one point in the early 90s, had the ownership back when the USWA was still around, and it ended up going into bankruptcy court. And then I know Corey Macklin now has been assuming the ownership of the tapes, but I don't think it's ever been clear cut as to who the exact ownership is. And Sherman can probably give us a better idea of who he dealt with.
I think certainly an interesting point would be Corey Macklin is not in the documentary at all.
No, he is not. Yeah. But he was always more connected with the newer
stuff. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. The later stuff, for sure.
Because it's interesting. This kind of ends around like
Kaufman, after the Kaufman.
Yeah,
stuff,
with like
basically.
The national expansion in like 84.
That's right.
And it's kind of Jimmy Hart leaves the territory is kind of the end of the documentary. So I don't know if it was something of they just had to cut it off at a certain point, or and that was their ending off point going into the cable era. But it just ends when Memphis still was, you know,
it's
thriving
still,
for a few more years.
Yes,
it was one of the last standing territories after the WWF went national that was still profitable into the late 80s, and then continued onwards into the 90s. Some other thoughts. Mouth, you being kind of the music, well, both of you, more so than me here. What were your thoughts in terms of the music in this documentary? Because I thought it was well done.
It's great. See, that's the great thing about Memphis, is that Memphis really was the first rock and wrestling territory. Like, this is amazing. Like, guys like Sputnik Monroe, Jackie Fargo, these guys all cut 45s. They, you know, Boogie Woogie Man cut 45. Jerry Lawler did a whole entire album.
Kamala.
You know, exactly. Like, and the book that kind of helped spawn this documentary, Sputnik, Masked Men, what's it called? Sputnik?
Masked Men, Midgets,
Sputnik Monroe,
I can't remember the exact
like
title.
But that book actually came with a CD, and they show the 45s in the book. So you had to have that rock and roll, of course, and then you have the Jimmy Hart connection to the Gentries and all that.
I think that helped a lot, that Jimmy Hart kind of spearheaded a lot of that. And it really set these personalities apart, and they had Jerry Lawler doing his song in this, which was just
can you imagine you go into the matches, and like nowadays you buy your favorite wrestler's t-shirt, but in Memphis you could, oh, there's Sputnik Monroe's 45, oh, look, there's Jackie Fargo, like that to me I think that stuff is brilliant, and they were definitely well ahead of the curve when it came to the rock and wrestling
and taking the camera outside of the arena of just simply showing matches. I thought Memphis and Texas did that really well with their television, and just thinking outside of the box when it came game to taking your talent and putting them outside of the ring.
Or literally outside the building as the vignettes they shot when Kamala came into the territory and they just went out in a field. Jerry Jarrett talks about it in his book. They just went out in a field somewhere and they took Kamala and dressed him up and, you know, shot these vignettes to help get him over.
Yeah. And I didn't think those songs were half bad either. Like it's not like like an R-Truth.
The funniest ones I find are the Lawler ones, because if you listen to them, they've put a hell of a lot of echo onto Lawler's voice to kind of cover up for some of the inadequacies. But some of the tunes, there's that one that always sticks in my mind, Trouble, Lawler did, that I thought was really, really good. But I thought it was great, yeah.
They had a Son of a Gypsy with a Boogie Woogie
Man. That was his 45, yep.
I really enjoyed that whole portion of the documentary talking about how Jerry Lawler, this guy that we watch every single week on TV, people at my age that don't know his real history.
And there's so much, too. Yeah. Isn't it amazing how much of a history he has?
That he was not even supposed to be a wrestler. The guy wanted to draw. And
sent his cartoons into Lance Russell, and Lance showed him on the TV.
Yeah, and was hired to write signs. That was his first job, and somehow that evolved into what he is today.
Yeah.
I feel like he has a whole DVD himself.
Oh, easily. I don't know if the WWE would be the ones to do it, but if somebody...
They don't have the footage.
Yeah, but if you... Yeah, a Lawler retrospective would be awesome, yeah.
I think there's like two different Jerry Lawlers, and for the people that only know him from the WWE, I mean, it's so hard to fathom that here was this guy who is legitimately one of the all-time, I think, greatest performers in this era, where we talked about how he was the key draw week after week here in the Memphis territory, and the stuff they show in here at the program with Rocky Johnson, the wrestler versus boxer. Yeah. I mean, Lawler for me is one of the greatest promos, I think, in the history of the business.
And for me, best punch. Lawler can still throw his punches are some of the most convincing punches you ever see.
And I was so glad they got the footage into with the empty arena match and Terry Funk's promo where he delivers the telegram to Lawler. I mean, Terry Funk was just this territory was so perfectly suited for a guy like Terry Funk.
Yeah. And plus, the idea was too, they built the angle up properly where an empty arena match actually made sense. Whereas remember TNA? Was it TNA that had one?
It was Sting and Angle
a while ago, and there was no reason to have it. They just probably someone saw some old Memphis footage and went, "Hey, let's do that." But whereas the Memphis one, it made sense, you know, it made sense while they were doing it.
And with Lawler as well, they kind of do show kind of just the history of the territory, where it kind of went in terms of your top babyface from Sputnik Monroe to Jackie Fargo, who was featured throughout the documentary, to Jerry Lawler, and kind of this lineage kind of from one to the next.
Yeah, that was something that I really enjoyed, because when you first told me about it, I was worried that it was just going to focus on Lawler. I'm like, okay, this is just going to be about law. But the fact that they were able to I'm glad that he went back and he did cover Sputnik Monroe, and he did.
Billy Wicks as well. That was cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, Sputnik Monroe, I mean, it's so important just for the whole thing breaking down the prejudice thing in Memphis and him connecting with the black fans and Sputnik being able to have enough power to go, hey, man, you let them sit down here with everybody else or I'm not going on. Like, that's major. That's huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's outside of wrestling altogether. That's pretty amazing.
They put the belt on Rocky Johnson, and I would have to imagine that he would probably be one of the first, if not the first, pro wrestling African American champion.
I think there was him. I believe like Thunderbolt Patterson at one point got a world title.
Was it a world title though?
This was a Southern title, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Rocky Johnson definitely would have been one of the first for a major territory, which Memphis certainly was at the time. It was also interesting that they talk about the kind of split between Jerry Jarrett with Nick Gulas and Roy Welch, and how his son, George Gulas, was kind of thrown into Jarrett and said, hey, you have to push my son. And it's like, here we are, 2011, and it's such a... I mean, it seems a constant theme within professional wrestling, and Jarrett just ended up breaking away from the territory and starting up on his own on the other network, took Lawler, took Lance Russell, took Dave Brown, and kind of shifted the entire power structure of that territory and took the northern cities in Tennessee.
He was really smart the way that he did that, and so that he wouldn't have to deal with those two guys, and he was able to get control himself. Plus, the good thing with Jerry Jarrett, he got to start so young. He got such great experience at an incredibly early age, his mom working in the box office. He was already booking small towns while he was in his teens. Mm-hmm. Like, he got incredible experience right out of the gate, and he was very smart with the way he handled all that whole situation.
And Jarrett's such an interesting personality. I'm about halfway through his book, and you've read the whole thing, Mouth, and it seems that this overall message that comes out of Jarrett is that, yes, he was very successful, but he overemphasizes just how this is not that difficult promoting professional wrestling. There's a good guy and a bad guy. People want to see the smaller guy overcome the bully, and what we do is really getting overthought today, and this shouldn't be so hard, and what I did was nothing. I don't think he downplays himself, but at the same time, doesn't try and make it seem like it's this big secret that no one can tap into. It's simple.
It's funny, when I was reading that part of the book, I really felt like I was listening to us do a regular show, because it's something that we talk about constantly in this day and age. And I think that's why he takes that approach in the book, because of the way it is nowadays. He really wants to show people that, look, man, it's not that hard if you just stick to your guns and you get two people that have some charisma and that the fans can connect with. It's not that simple. You don't need guys falling off buildings. You don't need cars being filled up with cement. It's just two guys, a rivalry, and there you go.
Sort of, you know, when you look at the WWE, who will have, you know, 4 to 5 hours a week of television to fill, and you're trying to sell a pay-per-view, it's like you get so much excess in there. Whereas I always remember in high school, our teacher, he gave us this assignment. He's like, I want a 750-word essay. And someone was like, can we write more? He's like, no, because then it's full of all this added shit that's not necessary. And you get your key stuff across with less. And I think that was the key here. You had a one-hour TV 90-minute show every week. And that was it.
Yeah.
And that was to push the following card. And it made it, I think, you were down to more basics. And it was an easier message to get across to your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally.
Mr. Ting.
What's up?
Anything you would like to add as well here? Some stuff from your notes.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about the Andy Coffin stuff. That really was. I wish I was around for it, to be honest with you. Cause,
it was pretty amazing way. It really was. Because as someone who was already a wrestling fan and like nobody really talked about it, me and my buddies liked it. It was before the WWF expansion, right? So we're still in the territory era. Yeah. And it was. It really was. It was outstanding. And it got. I can't downplay how much. Or overplay how much attention it got. Really did.
I would like to know, from what you could tell, how many people believed it? How many people thought this was legit?
A lot.
You know, I know.
A lot of people thought he had legitimately broke Kaufman's neck.
Because if you remember, when Lawler's book came out, and he mentioned the angle and referring to it as such, CNN even ran a news piece at the time, like this was breaking news, that this was an
fake
angle on David Letterman. I mean, and that was in 2002?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible right there. And I mean, Letterman actually, I remember reading the Saturday Night Live book, looking at the history, and they had interviewed Letterman for it, and he talked about this angle in it, and he refused to have any more wrestlers on after that. And David Letterman was a gigantic wrestling fan. He grew up in Indianapolis where Dick the Bruiser promoted, and after that deal with Kaufman and Lawler, he never wanted to have wrestlers on again, whether he felt it was
I think it was because
using his show as an angle and not informing
the fact,
them.
I think the fact that he was left out of the story, and plus also, Kaufman and Lawler did not specifically go in and plan what they did. It happened. It really did happen spur of the moment. They didn't go in and say, okay, you're going to mouth off and I'm going to lose it and I'm going to cork you. That's not what happened. It was the two of them took it upon themselves, right? And I think Letterman probably was upset that he wasn't alerted in advance, because I remember watching that episode, and I remember distinctly when they came back from commercial, Letterman did not look happy. He did not look happy.
It's up on YouTube. I just watched it yesterday.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it is up on YouTube.
He did not look happy afterwards, you know?
We should also mention, just in terms of the booking of this territory, they go into it very briefly here of how Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler would split up the booking, where one would book for 6 months and then the other would take over for 6 months and go back and forth. And this avoided burnout, and I think this was a very winning formula for this territory with these two people who I think clearly trusted one another. It wasn't any, you know, political back and forth of trying to outdo the other. It was simply this, you, great or bad, you have 6 months.
Yeah. Well, and how nice would it be to know that, hey, you know what? Oh, I'm burned out. I'm starting to fry out on this. I need a break from it. How great would it be to go, okay, Jerry, you take it for 6 months now, and I'll come back in 6 months. Like that, knowing that you have that, I think also makes it a lot easier.
And I'd assume that with the switchovers, you kind of have two season finales, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you have like a, you know, your first 6 months as a kind of one, what, with one director,
and have it kind of everything direction. Culminate
yeah,
in that,
kind of like comic books. You know how comic books always have like, you know, runs between groups of writers.
Maybe, yeah, right. And he'll, this guy will do it for a year or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. This guy will do Captain America for one right. year, and he'll tell his whole story for, right. for this 1 year, and then they'll move on to another set of writers, and it just keeps things fresh. So yeah. Doesn't work that way. No.
As the documentary ends, they do put a lot of focus on Jimmy Hart. Mm-hmm. And I mean, from just stuff we've gotten to see with Memphis airing on the Fight Network, I mean, as great as Jimmy Hart's stuff was in the WWF, I just think he was at a different level when he was part of the First Family here in Memphis, and just such an excellent heel.
Well, the thing, again, because I think Vince was trying to make it so cartoony in the 80s, I think... in Memphis, he got to be way more annoying. He was more of a caricature in the WWF, whereas in Memphis, he just got to be an annoying little dick. Like, I mean, he was just so good at pissing people off. Like, he was the best at getting people angry. You know, that high-pitched whine, he always, you know, they totally played up the fact that he was a chick, and they often would book him in matches, you know, he would run away and stuff like that. Like, I think in Memphis, because it was, again, more realistically based, he was much more effective.
And it was a great use of someone that did have a name outside of pro wrestling, bringing him in and incorporating him into the product. And eventually, his wrestling fame, I think, outgrew his fame with the Gentries.
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah, everybody knows him more for wrestling than the Gentries. I mean, the Gentries were kind of one-hit wonders. They had one big hit, right? So not too many. In fact, most people, when you tell them that, they don't know anything about that.
I thought it was hilarious when Jerry Jarrett said when he first met Jimmy Hart, he thought, really, that he was on speed.
Yeah.
In Jerry Jarrett's accent, which I thought he was on speed.
Yeah. You were just mentioning with Wade talking about the production of the documentary itself. There's one thing I want to mention that I think the show, it really is good, but I think this would have made it better, and I don't understand why it's not there. Where is Lance Russell?
That was the big question mark I had, because he was the connection from everything in Memphis from week to week. He was the person, the personality you were most familiar with, and he, to me, would have been an invaluable asset.
I just don't understand it. He was so involved with it. You watch, he's all over the clips. Like, you see the old footage. I mean, Lance is all over the place. And Lance was so good at playing the role. And again, it goes down to believability, because when Lawler would come out there and make outrageous claims, he would like he would make you think, oh yeah, come on, please. Like, I don't know, he was just so good at making you feel like, oh yeah, this guy's a jerk, or this guy really is the shining star they wanted. Like, I just thought Lance was so invaluable. Great presentation. I just love the way he interacted, especially with the heels. I love the way he interacted with the heels. And that, I don't think the promotion would have been nearly as successful without Lance Russell.
There was a brief segment touching on his contributions.
But where was he, though? Like, why don't, like that's something we have to ask the producer when we talk to him, because I don't understand how you could even think about doing it without putting Lance Russell, unless Lance himself didn't want to do it. That's the only thing I can think of.
It really hit home for me just how important your announcer is, of maintaining a credibility with the audience, with Jarrett talking about that, where if it was a good card, he would tell you, you can't miss this show, versus an average card where you just read it off.
Exactly. He pushed the ones that deserved to be pushed, and he gave the other ones, instead of everything being the greatest event in history, which is what we get nowadays, right? He knew how to temper that. He was very smart that way.
Yeah, it was just a very basic formula of just your play-by-play announcer is the guy that you bring into your living room every weekend. He is the person you trust, and that will sell you on the product. And that's why I just, say what you will about Michael Cole as a heel, he's in that wrong role where you don't have that kind of credibility with your announcer who has to sell the product.
No, the only guy that has any credibility is the guy they want to make fun of every week.
I thought it was great, too, the clip they had where it was Lance Russell signs off, and then you just hear him off mic. Can we get a camera down here? There's a fight going on. And it was like that kind of cliffhanger would have driven business the following week just from that simple, did we hear something we shouldn't have heard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, very true.
It's like hearing Dan Lavransky on the phone. Were we supposed to hear that?
Yeah, I don't know.
So overall, this documentary, I don't know if you guys wanted to hit on anything else here, but I just found this just such an enjoyable documentary. Just
I think if you're a wrestling fan, especially if you're an old school wrestling fan, you're going to totally love it. But I really think it's one that a lot of younger fans should watch because there's probably tons of fans now that have no idea what it really used to be. I mean, we're getting to the point now where it's been like the way it is now since, you know, like the late 90s kind of, and that's a whole chunk for certain people, and they might not realize what the history was like. And just to see, like, because the other thing about Memphis that I really love too, and I totally hate today that we don't have, is the kind of off the wall characters. And Memphis was full of them, with the Moondogs and Kamala and the Boogie Woogie Man, and like there were such great big bright characters, and now you got all cookie cutter guys that all look the same. That's one thing I totally love about Memphis is, you know, Plowboy Frazier. Like, he had crazy, crazy characters. And I personally miss that a lot in wrestling. I really do.
And I'm actually surprised that, I mean, in this day and age, I mean, there's lots of things you can look at from the territory days that people will say, oh, that can't work today. With the way that WWE's business model is, where licensing is so important and they've got the deal with Mattel, wouldn't you want to have more off-the-wall characters
for toys,
that you can monetize? I mean, are kids really running out and getting a Dolph Ziggler and Jack Swagger action figure set? I mean, just look at the marketing opportunities you would have with, say, a Kamala in 2011. If these different characters, to me, it's only a positive.
Yeah, no, I agree. When I was young, you had your clean cut athletic baby faces, and you had your maniacal heels, but then you'd also have crazy guys that were just like the Samoans or Curtis Iaukea and those guys that were just outstanding characters, and just it made it so different from anything else, right? But even with them, those type of characters, they would still try to keep it within the realm of reality, at least, you know, and you could buy into it.
Yeah. So that's going to wrap up our review of the show, but we've got actually two interviews here coming your way. The first is with Jimmy Hart, who I got to chat with recently in Toronto. It's a very quick interview, just discussing the documentary and his involvement with it.
At that time, Jimmy Hart was managing Lawler, and the thing was really popping around here.
Which came, the famous words, out of the mouth of Jimmy Hart. Lance Russell, what do you do when a horse breaks his leg?
You have a prize racehorse, a thoroughbred, a champion, and he breaks his leg. What do you do to him? What do you do to him, Lance?
Okay.
You shoot him, right? Jerry Lawler is no good to me anymore. He can't make me any more money, baby!
I wanted to ask you a bit about the Memphis Heat documentary, which some of us have had the opportunity to watch up here in Canada, looking at the infamous Memphis territory. I thought this thing was just fantastically put together.
You know, we had so much fun. I don't believe that we really realized what we really had happening back then, you know, with Lawler and Andy Coppin and myself and Dundee and all the people that really made that happen. But Jerry Jarrett used to say there was two sides of a coin. No matter heel or babyface, one of them can't draw without the other. I think you got to see a lot of things that really took place back then. Nothing was scripted. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't come in and go, okay, let's rehearse your interviews. You know, buddy, what you saw was what you got, especially the old Memphis TV stuff. I mean, we'd get there and you'd go out there and here's a couple of points you have to make. And, buddy, that was it. And if you didn't draw money, you didn't stay in that territory very long because we had no contracts back then. It was all a percentage of the houses. So we had to make money on Monday night at the Coliseum in Memphis and Tuesday night Louisville Gardens, Evansville Wednesday night. Everything was drivable back then, too. So it really separated the men from the boys back then.
Watching that documentary really brings up a lot of elements of the industry that I think people have gotten away from. What you mentioned about having to draw money and having to come back every Monday night in Memphis. And it was fantastic how you guys would fill the Mid-South Coliseum on such a weekly basis at times with the likes of Jerry Lawler, Jackie Fargo, and using those promos to bring people in. And, I mean, you had a large part to do with that.
And who'd ever think on Monday night, people used to go, Monday night, y'all's biggest show is on Monday night. Because look at Raw now. Raw's on Monday night, mm-hmm. You know, and it does tremendously well with the ratings. So I think Monday night is a good night. I think if you're a wrestling fan, any night's really a good night.
Getting back, just a few more things about the documentary in terms of watching that. I mean, tell us just a bit about your character at that time, because that's when people were kind of first introduced to Jimmy Hart through those tapes, which people still get to see footage of here and then. But just tell us a bit about the crafting of that character, which you go into in the documentary.
Well, you know what? Back in the day, of course, I came from a rock group called the Gentrys, One Hit Wonder. We had a million seller called Keep On Dancing. I told somebody the other day, I said, I feel like the Mick Jagger of professional wrestling. I've been around so many years and still doing this. But we were in high school, came out of high school. Jerry Lawler went to Treadwell High School. I went to Treadwell. He went into wrestling. I went into music, of course. I was doing the music after we didn't travel and have the hits and play in a local club there called Ramada Inn. You know, hey, the more you drink, the better we sound. Hey, but happy birthday, Mary, you know. But we were doing that night after seven nights a week, but it was a decent living. And then all of a sudden, Lawler called me and said, how would you like to do promotion for us? And I said, I'd love it. And he goes, how would you like to manage me? And I said, I'd love it, because I was a wrestling fan. So it really turned out to be a home run. But I just got to be Jimmy Hart. They let me be myself. They let me do what I wanted to do, and I think that's what helped me. Because if people didn't relate to it, I wouldn't be standing here today.
We're back here on Review Away, and joining us right now, we have just reviewed the entire documentary of Memphis Heat, and we're here now to chat with Sherman Wilmot, the executive producer of the project. And first of all, Sherman, thanks very much for taking some time out to chat with us about an excellent, excellent documentary that's getting a lot of positive reviews thus far.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
So my first question, Sherman, is just kind of your own background when it comes to professional wrestling and specifically the Memphis territory. Did you come into this project as a lifelong wrestling fan?
Yeah, I'm a big fan. That would be the word. I moved to Memphis in 1974, and it was just the glory days of Memphis wrestling. It was our only real entertainment here. We had no NBA team. We had no NFL team. So every Saturday morning, you turn on the TV and you just had your mind blown with these great shows put on by Lawler and Dundee and George Barnes and Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto and Jackie Fargo. It was must-see TV, and in Memphis, it was just the number one rated show. You can't believe how popular it was here.
And was this just a case of all the history involved with the Memphis territory that, you know, one day it just kind of clicked for you, like, let's get this story onto a DVD and get this story out to a mass audience that maybe isn't familiar with the history of Memphis?
Well, it really came from a project that I worked with Ron Hall, who's a co-conspirator of mine. He's the co-executive producer of the film. He and I have been working on various music projects in Memphis history for the last 10 years, mainly in the garage rock world. But Ron came to me with a book idea for like a coffee table book of the history of Memphis wrestling from the late 40s all the way up to the late 70s. And we ended up putting that out called Sputnik Mass Men and Midgets. And I said, well, let's do a little film to promote this book. And, we thought it would just be a little local thing for the local PBS station, but we got with the director, Chad Schaffler, and he ended up tracking down so many of the legends of Memphis wrestling. We didn't even know who was still alive at the time. We just knew that Ron grew up here in the 60s with Sputnik Monroe and Billy Wicks, and I grew up in the 70s with Lawler and Tojo Yamamoto and Plowboy Frazier. And then Chad, our director, grew up in the 80s, so we really brought like 30 years of fandom to the game, and we knew it would be popular here in Memphis. We just had no idea how popular it would be outside of Memphis. And I guess through the miracle of YouTube and networks like yours, people have really come to know and love the Memphis wrestling territory.
It's an absolutely amazing undertaking, the entire project. I've got to ask, how it must have been incredible when you actually sat down and said, okay, this is what we want to do. I mean, was it hard tracking down guys like Jackie Fargo or Sputnik Monroe, or did they all just seem to come out of the woodwork once you guys started?
Well, we made a list of the people we'd love to interview and, numbered them in priority, and we really honestly didn't even know who was alive at the time. And we ended up getting about 8 or 9 out of the top 10 or 15. A couple that we couldn't get were no longer with us, like Plowboy Frazier and Tojo Yamamoto. But we interviewed Jimmy Hart first, who was a big fan of the project. And then we interviewed Jerry Lawler and superstar Bill Dundee. And once Jerry Lawler saw the enthusiasm of our crew, he basically just started making phone calls to buddies like Jackie Fargo and opened up his kind of little black book and started making calls for us. So it actually was not that hard to get people once we had Jerry Lawler. It was just a question of, you know, the folks that we wanted to interview, were they still around? And we were fortunate enough to get people like Jackie Fargo, who gave a fantastic interview, Billy Wicks, who no longer lived in Memphis, lived over in North Carolina, and of course one of my all-time favorites, handsome Jimmy Valiant, who pretty much steals the show every time he's on screen.
Yeah, Jimmy Valiant was totally amazing. The one person that I thought was interesting that's kind of missing, that I think is an integral part of Memphis, was Lance Russell. How come there was no interview with Lance Russell?
Well, we had a lot of clips of Lance, and we started this project out as an extremely low-budget film. Like, you wouldn't even believe how low-budget it was. And so it was more of a logistical thing than anything. Lance currently resides in a beautiful part of the U.S. down in Florida, and most of the people we were going to interview and take a big crew with were up in Virginia, North Carolina, and East Tennessee area. So we pretty much had to decide between going for about five or six wrestlers that way or Lance Russell down in Florida. And knowing that we already had some interviews with Lance in the can, it made the decision easier. And you know, for all of us, you know, the most important interview of all was probably Jackie Fargo, because before King Lawler came along, he was the king of Memphis wrestling. And so he was the most important interview of everything. And so it pretty much based around logistics and financials, just getting to that part of the U.S. In a perfect world, we would have interviewed a lot more folks, but we only had 90 minutes to tell a story. And I think Lance comes out looking like the hero that he's been in broadcasting in the film anyway. So I think in the long run, it was a good decision.
Sherman, I think what really really helped this documentary was the fact that you're able to use as much footage as you seemingly wanted. And luckily, the WWE does not own this particular territory's footage. But who does is of you know, of interest to us, because we've heard rumors that Jerry Lawler and Corey Macklin are in dispute over some of this footage. Having dealt with whoever you did for this documentary, maybe you can shed some light.
Well, I can tell you who doesn't own it, and that would be Corey Macklin. Corey was kind of a recent entry to the Memphis wrestling world, relatively speaking. So it obviously it's in a very gray area, and we went through all kinds of hoops to make sure that our legal issues were covered. So I'll basically say that we're very comfortable that we've licensed the footage as best possible in a situation where it is extremely gray area, but that was something that was a big hurdle for us, and we have all of our contracts in line for that. So that's about as much as I want to talk about the rights on.
When it came to actual footage, Sherman, was there a lot out there? Because I can tell from the stuff that is in the documentary that a lot of it looks like it, you know, was from old VHS tapes that someone might have had. I mean, it must have been hard to even just hunt down some of the footage, because back in the territory days, the TV stations would just tape over everything.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this documentary is that it was in the era when there were just beginning to be beta recorders,
right,
beta tapes. Now, if you're old enough to remember this era, if you had a beta recorder or a VHS player in the 70s, you were rich.
Yeah, they were big. They were big, huge machines, and they cost a ton of money.
Yeah, and so most people weren't taping TV. They certainly weren't TiVoing, and they weren't, you know, doing a lot of tape trading. So even the TV stations, when they made the show, and this was part of the ingenious mind of Jerry Jarrett, is he would tape the show in Memphis and then send the tapes out a week or two later to different parts of the territory and repeat the matches in the show just by changing the names of the Coliseum and the city they were in. And that's, to me, one of the most genius things about this era. You couldn't possibly get away with it now, but the tapes were so expensive, even for the TV stations, that as soon as they were done with them, they would tape over them. So there weren't a lot of master tapes. So what you see in the film is kind of like best case scenario for you know, whatever potential clips are out there. We did get really lucky, and this is the kind of thing you dream of when you're doing a documentary. our director's wife ran into somebody whose uncle was a wrestler, and they'd shot a lot of Super 8 footage back in the 60s, and you see a lot of that used in there with Mario Galento, and I think there's some Freddie Blassie in there and some Billy Wicks. It's really hard to tell. It's so grainy, but it adds a great 60s quality to the film. That was a lucky thing that happened, but we did work with some super-duper collectors who had some rarities, and as we got closer and closer to the final version of the film, we would actually send out requests for certain matches. Obviously, some of them in the film, like the Tupelo Coliseum concession stand brawl was an important one, and the Lawler fight with the empty arena at the Coliseum. We wanted to show how creative the promotion was just by giving a taste of the matches that they were coming up with, and I think, you know, we didn't want to hit people over the head with it, but it was a really creative period for promotions, and the film itself isn't about matches. If you're just wanting to look at footage, there's plenty of that on YouTube, but it's the story behind the matches and behind the promotion and behind all these wrestlers who really kind of portrayed themselves on screens, and I think that's what made such a hot territory was, you know, these wrestlers weren't, you know, acting like Joe LeDuc was Joe LeDuc in real life.
Yeah, and that was something that I thought came across very strongly in the documentary. And when you're looking at a historical territory, Memphis is a perfect example. I mean, you could make a documentary that is just hours and hours because there's so much history attached to it, going back to Sputnik Monroe and even past where the documentary ends, where Jarrett started promoting with Texas. I mean, how difficult was it for you to find a logical out point here? Because obviously there is so much history here to this territory. And only 90 minutes here for you to kind of tell your story.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. The probably the hardest part of the whole documentary was, how do you tell a story of 40 or 50 years of history in 90 minutes and include all the most important matches, all the most important highlights and lowlights, you know? And that was probably the biggest challenge that Chad Schaeffler and our editor Pritchard Smith had was, not only do we want to tell the story for the people who grew up with it, just kind of as a nostalgia historical piece, but also for the people who didn't live with it from all over the world. And how do you do that in 90 minutes? And I think they did a fantastic job, but it was based on, you know, we started with the matches that Sputnik Monroe and Billy Wicks had that really set the fire for the beginning of Memphis wrestling in the late 1950s. They just had these epic brawls that really got people interested in wrestling. And the book that Ron put together kind of ends in the late 70s when the territory is really on fire. And kind of, you know, with Jimmy Hart and Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman, the epic month-long battles that they would have, we kind of extended it a little bit more into the 80s. And our cutoff point was kind of when things started changing, and that's when cable TV came on. And in America, you know, that was, you know, Turner down in Atlanta starting to buy up a lot of the talent. And then, you know, of course, the eventuality of WWF and WWE. So basically, we kind of left it like when Jimmy Hart left because there was more money on the table for cable, and then Lance Russell left a few years later. That was the beginning of the end of what was one of the last territories in the U.S. So it's kind of a natural ending there. And, you know, we've had a lot of people say, well, you know, there's so much more to do. Well, that certainly leaves open an opportunity for a sequel or follow-up, but that wasn't really our intention. It was just kind of, that was where the story really changed and things became a lot different in the wrestling and, you know, in the cable world.
I think one of an interesting part of it that you could maybe almost do a whole documentary on was the whole rock and roll connection to the Memphis wrestling, and how Memphis wrestling was really the first place to incorporate these two elements that have so many common characteristics and go together so well. One of the highlights for me, I'm an avid music collector, was when I got the book that you guys did first, and the CD that was in there with, you know, the Jimmy Valiant song and Sputnik Monroe song. And could you talk maybe a little bit how all that stuff came about, and how important the rock and roll part really seemed to be important to what made Memphis wrestling what it was.
Yeah, that's one of the super fun aspects of it. I'm glad you picked up on that. Both Ron Hall and I are huge music collectors and fans. At a record store for many years in the 90s. But growing up here, the music aspect of the wrestling was huge. Handsome Jimmy's song that you referenced on that CD that we put in the book, that was like a number one hit in Memphis when I was a kid.
Wow.
And you woke up in the morning and it was played in heavy rotation.
That's amazing.
On the way to school. So, Lawler's songs were not as popular, but they were certainly regular and in rotation. Jimmy Hart was a huge part of that because of his history with the Gentrys and his history with the studios, and that's kind of how it all got going, to the point where even Plowboy Frazier was putting out 45s, and all these guys used music kind of as a novelty to sell at the matches. But I think the big influence was, you know, the entrance music they were using in the making of music videos, which Jerry Jarrett brought in the early 80s. And it's just part of the deal was, and it's kind of hard to understand, or, you know, if you're a WWE fan, you can probably understand, but these guys in Memphis were like athletes and rock stars. So they would hang out with musicians. And when you look at the back of Jerry Lawler's records, you look on the back and see who played on them, the Memphis Horns, James Burton, Elvis's guitar player, because these musicians were huge fans too. In fact, Elvis was a big wrestling fan and would go to the matches and had to hide behind the curtain because they're so popular. But that's, even dated a wrestler. It's kind of like, you know, music and wrestlers in Memphis were kind of our celebrities. So, and also it's a really fun aspect of the whole business is the wrestlers as rock stars. And one of my favorite stories, and I'll tell real quickly on the DVD extras is, you know, Lawler was so hated here that he would sell his 45s at the matches, and people would buy them and break them just to show how much they hated him. And the guy at the match would say, "Hey, if you really hate him, why don't you buy another one and break it again so they can sell more of them?"
That's amazing. Has there ever been the idea, I mean, since you are a record guy, record store, about maybe just doing a CD compilation of some sort? I mean, it's not going to sell huge numbers, but guys like myself, I would love something like that.
Yeah, Jimmy Hart's kind of done a small version of that. I don't know, you know, if we could track down more stuff, you know, we kind of pick like just the easy ones for the book, and there's definitely more, but some of the stuff is quite honestly horrendous music. But
that's part of the charm.
It's certainly fun. I mean, it doesn't get any better than Freddie Blassie doing Pencil Neck Geeks,
right,
and Sputnik Monroe's trying to fire his band in the studio.
It seems, Sherman, that, you know, today in 2011, fans have a certain connotation when they say professional wrestling, and nine out of ten times it's linked to the WWE. But in certain cities that have that historical past, like a Memphis or a Toronto or a Houston, professional wrestling seems to have a different kind of, I think, respect from the general public. What is it specifically you found with Memphis that was so tied to professional wrestling where the city seemed to almost stop on Saturday mornings for the weekly 90-minute show, and that city remained very strong locally when it came to pro wrestling, even after the territory folded?
Well, that's another great question, and I thought about that a lot. You know, growing up here, that all we had was Memphis wrestling, so we don't really know how good or bad it was in Oklahoma or Seattle or wherever, but I can tell you this. Because of Lance Russell and Dave Brown doing the commentating, and because of Jerry Jarrett's behind-the-scenes work with the TV show, and because they had so much really excellent regional talent, and when I'm talking about Lawler and Dundee and the mainstays, and then they would bring in the bigger stars to take on Lawler, you know, like an Andre the Giant or
Flair,
you know, Jack Briscoe, Harley Race, whoever would be kind of the main event. It was just constantly entertaining. It was a soap opera that you had to see. If you didn't see it, you missed out. And then they built up the matches for Monday night from the Saturday TV show to a frenzy. And it was just well done. And you could call it wrestling, or it could have been rock and roll, or it could have been sports. But what they were doing was putting a product on the table that people wanted and they had to have. And fortunately for Memphis and the promoters, there wasn't a lot of competition, you know, with cable and other sports teams. But it was just so good that that's why it's still respected. If you talk to people who are, say, 40 years and older in the region, they may or may not watch WWE, but they certainly remember the good times in Memphis in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, just because it was, you know, one great wrestling match after another, or great storyline after another.
You mentioned near the beginning of the interview how in Memphis you really only had the Memphis wrestling. You didn't have any other kind of big sports teams or anything like that. Do you think that that would have made a difference if there had been a bigger sports franchise for the city to rally around, or would it still have the Memphis wrestling still have captured the attention the way it did?
I think it would have been a little more difficult, but because the product, the wrestling was so strong, I don't think it would have lost its luster, you know, because there were other things to do. We did have an ABA franchise in basketball in the early 70s. We did have other forms of entertainment around here, of course, but I don't think that would have affected things as much as if the product that they were delivering was inferior. But it was just so strong that you couldn't really stop it. And, you know, just when you think it was dying down, or, you know, there's a great example in the film when Lawler breaks his leg playing football on the weekends, you know, Jimmy Hart comes along and just sets the territory on fire. So it just seemed like they had a 30-year run that just never really slowed down. Or it might slow down a little bit, but then someone else would come along and gather more heat, hence the title of the film.
It's interesting. One of the most fascinating comments I found in the documentary came from Jerry Jarrett, where he talked about when 12,000 fans would come to the Mid-South Coliseum, probably only 1,000 of those 12,000 actually believed what they were seeing was real. But it was a case of just the others suspending their disbelief because it was a very believable product. They had believable characters. And I think that's something that when an angle still hits today, you can hit that suspension of disbelief. But I think more often than not, it's not presented in that same fashion, and thus wrestling fans, you don't get that same emotional attachment that you got in territories such as Memphis.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that's part of why the good old days were the good old days. And I'll just give you one example this year when CM Punk went off message this summer.
Yep.
Whether he did or not, I don't know, but it was so unusual for anyone to do anything that seemed like it was off message that it just created this huge buzz for them and WWE. And that wasn't unusual in Memphis. It was every week you didn't know what to expect. And so, you know, that's why you had to watch the show. And, you know, back then, if you didn't watch the show, it wasn't like you could pick up on it on Twitter later or, you know, see the YouTube video. You just didn't get to see, you know, some great entertainment, and then you had to go down to the Coliseum on Monday to find out what was going to be the resolution. Or, of course, it never was resolved because somebody would interfere at the end of the match and they'd have to continue it for the next week or month. And that's why it just, you know, it never slowed down, because there was so much interest and just such well-played storylines. And, you know, I think that's what's missing from wrestling in the last, you know, couple decades is, like, You're not really looking at 6 months down the road. You're looking at it like tomorrow. You know, they gotta sell out a big Coliseum or, you know, 20,000 place in Cleveland tomorrow. You know, so how are you gonna sell tickets for that? Well, you gotta put everything you got into that one event, and then you haven't left anything to build it up on.
You also, I think, established this cushion that the WWE has, where drawing on a week-to-week basis, I mean, you kind of have this built-in audience versus the territory days where, for some of these promoters, it was week-to-week in terms of drawing a gate and staying in business, which is not one of the pressures the WWE has, and whether it be, you know, licensing money from television outlets, and therefore I think it's created much different priorities which we see.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument for them. They could take more chances and still have a fan base. You know, if you're not living week to week or day to day, as some of the wrestlers were back then. But, you know, I just think that speaks to the faith that Jerry Jarrett had in the fans coming along if you give them enough of a good storyline to keep them interested, even if it's something that, you know, no one has ever done before, like a scaffold match or, you know, one of the greatest storylines we didn't get to in the film, which I would have loved to, but it was just one of many, was, you know, Bill Dundee put his wife's hair on the line. I mean, that was just, to this day, that's one of the funniest things I've ever heard of in my life.
Were there any other scenes that maybe didn't make it into the documentary, that it was just a case of time that you would have liked to have seen in there?
I'm pretty pleased with the final effort. I mean, if we put anything else in it, we would have had to take something else out. And, you know, as much as we did this film for wrestling fans, we also wanted non-wrestling fans to kind of get a taste of the great storylines. And each of these guys in the film could have had their own documentary done on them. So if we pulled anything out, like if we pulled out any of the great stuff about, you know, Sputnik Monroe's influence on the civil rights movement, or if we pull that into stuff about how tough it is on the road for these guys, then we would have had to, you know, miss part of the storyline. So I don't think we could have shoved anything else in there without taking something away. That said, you know, this movie could have been made 200 different ways because there were so many great storylines over the years. And it was just a question of, like, you know, I would have loved to have more stuff on the tag team guys in the 60s, not because they were popular, but because they were great wrestlers and had great stories. And, you know, other people wanted more recent wrestlers, maybe the Fabulous Ones or the Rock and Roll Express. But that's kind of going into the next generation, too. So maybe there's hope down the road for something like that.
Now, of all the stuff that you did cover, there's a very interesting clip in the documentary where Jerry Jarrett, because of course you have to talk about the Andy Kaufman situation with Lawler, because that was huge at the time. I remember it being a gigantic thing at the time. And Jerry Jarrett says, he talks about how, well, you know, a lot of people pick that as kind of the pinnacle or the high point of Memphis wrestling, but he didn't agree with that. Now, he didn't expand on what he thought it was, but I'm just curious from your point, Sherman, what do you see as kind of like the crown jewel in the history of Memphis? Is it the Kaufman stuff or is it something else?
Well, in terms of promotions, I don't think anyone could argue that it wasn't the highlight, just because, you know, here we are in 2011 talking about something that happened in 1982, and people still love the Kaufman stuff. And me personally, it was a highlight because I couldn't believe how great it was every week back then. And nationally, it was on David Letterman, and it was a one-time deal. But in Memphis, this went on for like a year, year and a half, and they kept coming up with ingenious ways for Andy to keep coming back and double-crossing Lawler and then double-crossing Hart and vice versa. So for me personally, it was a huge highlight. And we did cut down the Kaufman part in the movie because we didn't want to overemphasize it, but you couldn't do it without including it. I think I understand completely why Jarrett thinks that. It's just because it was less maybe wrestling involved and more of a pop culture phenomena, but it was such a great pop that it brought people into the wrestling that never would have seen it, and it really made it a kind of you know, put Memphis on the map nationally. So, you know, I think Jerry Lawler's record as being the number one draw in Memphis and helping to pay for all the bills in the Coliseum, which it was going, it was losing money before they moved the wrestling to the Coliseum, and then it became the number one draw. And the number of sellouts he had there, I think, is probably more of a testament to how good it was over a period of decades than any one promotion or any one event that they had.
It's funny that whenever you talk to wrestlers from the Memphis territory or just anywhere, it seems that Nick Gulas and Roy Welch are generally regarded as the lowest on the rung of promoters when it came to just being ethical promoters. Did you have any stark contrast from some of the performers you chatted with that maybe had different opinions of Welch and Gulas? Because they tend to have a bad reputation amongst the wrestlers that work for them.
Yeah, I think that was pretty unanimous. Not one person really had anything positive to say about their payouts at the very least. And, you know, I think the best thing that was said about them was we put in the movie because we wanted to be balanced, was what Buddy Wayne said. And Buddy Wayne basically said that they weren't any worse than any other regions, which isn't a compliment. It's just saying that's the way it was. And for the wrestlers, it got a lot better when Jarrett took over, because not only was he a wrestler, but, you know, he was a good businessman. He knew that if you don't pay these guys, they will leave. So, you know, I don't want to be too much insider because I wasn't there, but, you know, when out of eight or nine people you interview say the same thing, then it's almost unanimous there.
Before we wrap up here, Sherman, some listeners also sent in some questions, so we'll just go through these really quickly. Brent Oliver wants to ask, did you specifically make the documentary for wrestling fans, casual fans, or the general public? And I know you kind of answered that, but just a follow-up to that as well is kind of the balancing act of trying to make it appeal to the hardcore wrestling fan and the other person who maybe has just heard the name Jerry Lawler going into this documentary.
We made the film for both, and I think that was, as I said, that was the hardest thing to do in 90 minutes, get a film that would appeal to, say, just casual film goers, normal people, and then make a film for wrestling fans. And I think based on the responses we've had from the wrestling world, we were definitely successful in the getting wrestling fans interested. And I think part of that was, you know, you may have seen clips on YouTube or you may have heard about this or that, but, you know, to coherently tell the story to an outsider to where they get, you know, why people love the Memphis territory so much. I think we did that for wrestling fans. And we've had enough of a response with, you know, casual viewers that are like, well, I would never go to a wrestling match, but, you know, I love those characters. I love Jackie Fargo, or I love Sputnik Monroe. You know, I didn't know he did all this for civil rights. You know, I think we're there too. We just have had such a tremendous response from the wrestling world that it really hasn't crossed over into the, you know, pop culture world. And I hope it, and I think it will, because, like I said, the storylines there are so strong and the characters are so strong. And, you know, how can you not be interested in what Sputnik Monroe was doing in the segregated South in the early 60s, before the civil rights movement really even kicked in?
We go to Andrew Hickey. He says, Memphis Heat is one of the best documentaries I have ever seen, and he wants to know if there were any people that weren't open originally to being involved with the documentary and may have had resistance at the start when you approached them.
I got to be honest with you. I think, you know, whenever you're doing anything for the first time, people are always hesitant to be involved, because they don't want to be portrayed in either a negative fashion, or they don't want to waste their time doing something that actually won't be completed. The biggest stumbling block we had was with Jerry Jarrett, and it wasn't because he didn't want to be involved. It was because he had a contractual obligation with another company not to do any interviews at the time. And because it took us about 2 years from start to finish of the documentary, over that period of time, that contract lapsed, and so we were able to get him interviewed, as well as Soul Man Rocky Johnson right towards the end, which both of those interviews really kind of put a cherry on top of the whole project. And I don't think it would have been nearly as strong a documentary without Jerry Jarrett's wisdom in there.
Oh, and I think you're also lucky just in certain terms of timing too as well, Sherman, because Jerry Jarrett putting out his autobiography at this same time as the Memphis Heat documentary is coming out, I think that's a really nice 1-2 punch, so people can really, really get a gist of what Memphis was all about.
Oh, man, if you haven't read his book, you need to get online and order it today.
Oh, I have. I've read it. I've read it already.
Oh, I know. I mean to your listeners, okay. Because it's beyond wrestling. He's such a smart business person and creative mind that it's about wrestling, but there's more to it than that, and I highly recommend his book.
How lengthy was that chat, Sherman? Because, I mean, Jerry Jarrett, I mean, was the key to all of these angles at the time, and I've got to imagine that interview was quite the endeavor.
Yeah, I think he was just ready to open up and talk, and because we'd already done all the other interviews at the time, our director, Chad Schaffler, had, you know, the right questions for me. It wasn't a lot of wasted energy there, and Jared just kept giving poignant response after poignant response, and it was just very fortuitous that we were able to include him in the film, because, You know, he's just so well spoken, and he has such a great mind. It's just nice to watch him think and see the process in his mind of how he promoted and why this worked this way or that. It's just he's definitely got to be one of the greatest minds in wrestling of all time.
And the final question comes from Nate Milton, who just wants to know your opinion, Sherman, if the WWE's involvement with the USWA ultimately helped or hurt that organization.
I think Jerry Jarrett said it best in the film, and I don't really have an opinion on that specifically, but everything changed so much with the internet, and what they were doing in Memphis worked because of the time and the technology involved. And I go back to the sending the tapes out to Louisville and Lexington and Nashville and other cities and replaying the matches without people knowing how they ended up 2 weeks later. And then Bill Dundee told me that they were doing this down in Bill Watts' territory in the 80s, but instead of doing it for 2 weeks ahead, they were 6 weeks ahead, so it was really hard to keep up with what had happened and what hadn't. But then anyway, the point is, what they were doing was so related to the technology of the times that I don't think they could have kept the territory system going any longer. And obviously, the only place that it did really last much longer was in the Memphis area. And I think that is a testament to the popularity of Jerry Lawler in Memphis and the region. And you know, to this day, he's huge in WWE, but, I mean, he's the hardest working man in wrestling. He's in every small town or on, you know, WWE every night of the week. So it's kind of hard to explain the love that people have in the South for Jerry Lawler. It's been so long and built up for so long that it's just really, really strong, and that's what kept Memphis going longer than anything.
Yeah, and I think it's something that if you were not there in Memphis, you can't fully comprehend just how big a star Jerry Lawler was. If your only exposure to him is seeing him on Raw every Monday, it's really just that really came across in the documentary for me with Lawler. And Sherman, I want to thank you so much for chatting with us. This has been a great chat looking behind the scenes here of Memphis Heat. And I want to kind of give you the platform here of where listeners, if they haven't seen the documentary yet, it does have a theater run that you guys are currently involved with. And where can they check out the documentary?
You can order it from our website at www.memphis-heat.com. And any day now, it should be up on iTunes or Amazon for a download. And those are the best ways to see it. I would highly recommend all the extras. We added about 2 hours of extras that didn't fit into the film onto the DVD. And that's not because they were extras that were junk. They just didn't fit into that 90-minute format. So I think the DVD, 4 hours of it, will give any fan an intro to Memphis wrestling that will make you a fan for life. And I want to thank you guys for having us on there, and we love talking Memphis wrestling anytime.
Where is Lawler? I told you that the son of a bitch didn't have enough guts.
Now, please watch your language, will you? Because for crying out loud, we can't use a thing with you swearing like that.
I don't give a damn. I've heard enough of your
Listen.
Shit. I've heard enough of the shit from the people of Memphis. I've heard enough shit from everybody about how good this man is supposed to be.
Well, you just, it's just a little. He may have gotten tied up
exactly
in traffic or something like
exactly
that. I don't know.
O'clock right now.
So that was Sherman Wilmott, and once again, I highly recommend people go check out Memphis Heat as we draw to a close this review. And that was very interesting, some of the kind of just the production side of things.
Yeah, it's tough when you got something like that where it's something that's relatively in the past now, and it's also from an era. Like, we live in an era now where everything is cataloged, everything is kept, everything is, you know. Whereas in those old territories, because they were small TV stations and they didn't have a lot of money, man, they would just tape over the tapes every week, and it's awesome that is able to be documented. People can see it and know what an effect it had. And again, I urge you younger fans, you know, that if you're you've come to wrestling late, you've only started watching maybe in the Attitude Era or when Nitro was hot or whatever, to check out something like Memphis Heat, because you really need to see what it was like. For me, who was kind of around as a kid in the territory days, it's just such an amazing metamorphosis from what it was when I was a kid to what it is today. Mm-hmm.
All right, we just have a few bits of feedback here for those that didn't have questions for Sherman that we got to in the interview. Start off with Ross Bowler, who writes, I thought this was an amazing documentary. It was amazing how much emotion and passion the Memphis fans were, much like world class. It's also sad because you will never get that true emotion again in wrestling, where every week the wrestlers had the crowd in the palm of their hand.
Yep.
I think you can draw a lot of parallels between this and the two world class DVDs that came out over the last couple of years.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely, man. That was the thing. The believability was there. And when you have the believability, just like, you know, in MMA today, when you have the believability, the people will come.
Justin Foe writes, for my money, Memphis Heat is one of the best pro wrestling documentaries out there. What I took from this was how simplistic yet effective it was back then. Maybe the current crop of writers could take some notes from this documentary. let's continue onwards here. Just a few more we have from Jordan Ducharme. I could see someone who doesn't understand, appreciate, or respect wrestling seeing this documentary and either laughing or feeling sick. When I saw it, though, I thought it was very well done and very interesting. My dad used to follow Memphis wrestling and would tell me stories as a kid when we were watching wrestling together, so actually getting to see the characters and moments was good, and it's great to see a documentary about a slice of wrestling that I don't know very much about.
Yep, yep.
And let's just finish off here with, Brenta Oliver just simply wrote, great documentary.
Well, sometimes simple is best.
And that is going to draw us to a close. I want to thank Sherman Wilmot, Jimmy Hart, and Dan the Mouth Lavransky for coming in. Thank you very much,
No
Mouth,
problem. Anytime, guys. Anytime.
Lending your expertise to us. And, Wei, as we look ahead to next week, what are we going to be reviewing?
Well, let's review The Rock's return to Survivor Series from 2001, 10 years ago. This was during the invasion, if you'll remember. And
the end of the invasion.
The very end of the invasion.
The four-month dream feud.
Yeah.
There you go. So Survivor Series 2001. Team Alliance versus Team WWE.
But wait, was it a happening?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah, I don't think it was a happening. It was a monstrosity, I think, that this invasion was ending after
so
4 months.
Bad.
So we've gotten a lot of requests for that, so we will end off with that. As always, you can get all your info at liveaudiowrestling.com, reviewaway.com. We'll be back on Friday with Review and Impact, along with Nate Milton. And what else can we end this show off with than with some music, courtesy of the Memphis Territory? And this is Jerry Lawler at his finest.
We're going to give you as much of Wrestling with Girls as we possibly can. It's my brand new record. Call your favorite radio station and put the pressure on them to play the record, right? FM 100 especially. And right now, without any further ado, we'll tell you we're going to see you next week again at 11 o'clock with another Jerry Lawler show. And right now, let's get on with it, fellas.
Ladies and gentlemen. and gentlemen, and welcome to this three-fall, winner-take-all, no-holds-barred Friday night match. In this corner, the luscious Susie Q, tonight's challenger.
And you better say your prayers, big boy, because tonight, you're going down.
Friday night match in the bedroom tonight. One-on-one till the morning light. No-holds-barred.